This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on January 13th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. In September, Dahlia Lithwick and Scott Pilutic wrote an opinion piece in Slate titled "From Abortion to Voting, Texas is Set on Making It Illegal to Help People." They claimed that it was not coincidental that SB 1, voting restrictions, and SB 8, banning practically all abortions, converged in 2021. Quote, "Texas Republicans are acutely aware that as their numbers contract demographically, they can't continue to rule over racial and ethnic minorities or pass unpopular laws like SB 8 unless those minorities are systematically discouraged from voting." Unquote. They point out that SB 1 enables laws like SB 8, which seriously runs against public opinion. Both laws confer certain enforcement and police powers on random citizens. SB 8 provides an explicit $10,000 bounty for anyone willing to prosecute whoever would assist a woman to obtain an abortion. SB 1, on the other hand, essentially ensures the, quote, "harassment and intimidation of voters and ballot counters in order to combat non-existent voter fraud," unquote. They go on to condemn SB 1 as, quote, "a vicious blend of some of the more oppressive and discriminatory ideas any state has dared to entertain," unquote, in the matter of restricting voting rights. SB 1 mandates strict restrictions on absentee ballots and voting by mail. Furthermore, it limits times for voting, and it makes registration more difficult, among other constraints. However, the authors are really perturbed by the section of the law that mandates free movement of partisan poll watchers. They envision that some self-deputized patriot is sure to charge that a box of uncounted ballots belongs here and not there, setting off more of the lunacy that we all witnessed in the aftermath of the 2020 election. And it will all be live-streamed so we can referee from our couches. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guests this evening include Grace Chimane from the League of Women Voters of Texas. Grace is president of the Texas League. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan, grassroots civic organization that encourages informed and active participation in government, works to increase understanding of major public policy issues, and influences public policy through education and advocacy. We also have Charlie Bonner, Communications Director for MOVE Texas. MOVE is a nonpartisan, nonprofit grassroots organization building power in underrepresented youth communities through civic education, leadership development, and issue advocacy. And in case you're wondering, it stands for Mobilize, Organize, Vote, Empower. We also have Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, and Michelle Manning Scott,
associate producer of the show, who has also volunteered for the league over the years. Welcome, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us. I'd like to start by having each of our guests introduce themselves. So, Grace, why don't you take it from there? Who are you and how did you get into this work?
I am Grace Shemaine, and I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Texas, and I joined the league in 2012 during that election. And then I rapidly joined the state league because I was interested in going to the Texas Capitol.
Charlie, tell us a little about yourself.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us. It's great to be back. My name is Charlie Bonner. I use he, him pronouns. I'm the communications director here at Move Texas, where I've been for the last 3 years. I've been registering folks to vote and been involved in this fight since I was in middle and high school. And so really glad to be continuing this fight here. I'm at this really critical moment for our democracy and for Texas writ large.
Grace, tell us a little more about the league. I think a lot of people have heard of the League of Women Voters and probably are most familiar with your voter guides, but tell us more about the mission and history and what kind of activities you're all involved with.
Well, the League of Women Voters in Texas has been around since 1919, so we're over 100 years old. And our mission is empowering voters and defending democracy. I love our mission because it's so important, especially today, that we empower the voters in Texas and that we also defend our democracy. It's why we're here. It's our form of government, and we're proud to be a part of it. We're very nonpartisan. We never support or oppose political parties or political candidates. There are like 34 leagues in Texas. We have them in the big cities like Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, El Paso. But we also have them in small areas like Lavaca County and Cook County. If there's a group of people that want to get together and form a league and empower the voters in their community, then we'll help them do it. Most all the leagues have a committee that is committed to voter education. And that voter education committee does voter registration. They do it all over the community and in high schools and in colleges. In any place that people are gathering, then we are there registering voters. The other thing they provide is the voter's guide. If you're lucky enough to have a league in your community, then your voter's guide, when there's an election, will go through all the candidates, all the way down to the local candidates. So you'll know who's running for constable or who's running for school board, and you'll be able to compare those candidates and decide which ones you want to vote for. If you don't have a league in your community, then you'll get what we provide, which goes through like the State Board of Education on up through the governor. We provide that voter's guide in print at libraries across Texas and online at vote411.org. We ask the questions and the candidates answer, and we put it up there. Whatever they say, whatever they write, whatever their grammar is, it's going in there.
And Michelle, you've been involved with the league, right?
Yeah, so I've been a member of the Austin Area League since, I believe it was the spring of 2019. And yeah, and so that's how I got involved in becoming a VDR, voter deputy registrar, registering people to vote here in Travis County and also up in Williamson County. Tried to get involved pre-pandemic in the high school education program that the league runs to educate young people that are just coming into voting age and getting them registered to vote too at the high school level.
And I know you're probably tired of hearing this, but we were so proud of you last year during the election. You were actually an employee of the Travis County clerk, right?
Yeah. So I was part of the drive up voter registration effort at the Airport Boulevard tax office there. So with Dana DeBeauvoir and the whole issue of everything that was going on last year during the election. So yes, that was an interesting and eye-opening experience.
Well, Charlie, tell us a little about MOVE.
Absolutely. First, we have to thank the League of Women Voters for that voter guide that is truly indispensable to not only every organization, but every voter in the state, and is a giant pain to put together. So I do not envy them, but I'm very grateful. MOVE has an interesting history. actually started as a student organization, as a club on campus at the University of Texas at San Antonio back in 2013. Just a small group of students who got together, saw how low the youth voter turnout rates were in San Antonio specifically, and just started registering their friends and their classmates to register to vote. And it really changed San Antonio politics, just increasing that youth vote share by the 1,000 or so folks that they did in their first couple of years was so dramatic that it flipped city council seats. It really had a seismic impact on the community. And so many other student chapters started to form. People wanted to replicate that model in San Antonio. MOVE became a San Antonio-based nonprofit at that point. And then in 2018, we went statewide, again, replicating that and focusing on young people, particularly young people of color, and making sure they have access to the information that they need to be voters. And so now we're working all over this giant state. We've got more than 30 full-time staff right now. And we're really building power alongside Texas's young people and are fundamentally changing the electorate here in the process.
So presumably you work hard to motivate students. How do you do that? I mean, do you have like rallies or how do you work up enthusiasm about voting?
Yeah, what we see right now is this generation of young people understands the issues. We have people marching in the streets. We have folks protesting, signing petitions on whatever issue it is that they care about, be it racial justice and eliminating police violence or more local things on their campus like ending campus sexual assault. Young people know what they stand for. Our job is to show them how their values show up on a ballot. So if you're a young person that is passionate about the climate crisis and making sure that we're taking action, the conversations that we're having with those folks is, well, did you know that your city council person could put forward a Green New Deal for your city that could really take action to make sure that the city has electrically efficient buses, you know, whatever that specific is, how we make that tangible for people. And if we can get those folks who are already passionate about the issues to show up in that local election, to be informed on their city council race or their DA's race, because there's someone that cares about police violence, that person's going to become a lifelong voter. They're seeing the local impact that is so much more profound than when we just get excited about a presidential race. We're showing young people how they can really make a difference on their values, and that fundamentally changes things. That builds up that confidence when you can show the impact of your vote, and that creates a lifelong voter.
Well, it's kind of tragic that with all of your activities and the league's activities to encourage voting, that we've got legislation now in Texas and across the country that seems to be working in the other direction.
Certainly. And I don't think we should take that as a coincidence, right? We see these voter suppression efforts right now by the governor as a direct result of our work. The mass change in the youth vote that we've seen being driven by young people of color in this state is worrisome to the people who do not think that they can win on the issues. And if they can't win on the issues, they have to change the rules. That is the process that we are seeing right now. This isn't a fluke. This is showing how the system works for them, that they are fortifying their own power.
Do you have the same sense about that, Grace?
I think that we already had a complicated election law and policies in place. And now we have a much more complicated system in place. And I'm seeing it every day. The new election laws that passed went into effect in early December, and we are seeing the impact on the vote by mail. There's a new application. It's kind of a mess. I don't want to share that too much because I want people to still be able to do it. So what I normally say is, you can do it, and we're here to help. But it does take a lot more help here in Texas for people to be able to vote, and it shouldn't be that hard.
So basically, SB1 has introduced some more hoops to jump through, to put it simply. It's probably much worse than that, huh?
It wasn't helpful. It wasn't helpful at all. And I'm really concerned that we're going to see the impact of that legislation with our older voters, with our voters who are disabled, with the young voters, low-income voters especially, I think are going to be the ones who are impacted by this. The vote by mail application now has voter ID information that is required. And that voter ID information has to be the same as what's on your voter registration application that you might have applied for 10 years ago and on your vote by mail ballot. And if you make a mistake, the county may help you fix it. It's very frustrating. We have some videos and we have some tools on our website that'll help people be able to still vote by mail.
Questioning that, regardless of vote by mail being a safe and secure option from which that millions upon millions of voters have cast ballots for decades, someone questioning that, that's the point. They are trying to undermine our trust in the system, and we can't let them. And in part, what that means is we have to talk about what these laws do. We have to talk about what it actually means. We have to become the election experts we wish our leaders actually were, so that we know that our friends and family are going to have the accurate information that they need to be voters, so that they can trust this system. That's going to be, I think, the next step for all of us. It's not going to be good enough for us to just show up and vote. We're going to have to bring people with us. We're going to have to get educated on that system and help people navigate this intentionally wonky system.
Well, there are limitations on times and on places. You know, it would appear that the governor and the triumvirate at the top of the state were pretty torqued about what was happening in Harris County a year ago, November. So there's all these procedural changes. But in addition to all that, the one that I'm really concerned about is what actually takes place at the polling places and what actually takes place at the election processing facilities. Can either of you comment on changes at the polling place, for example? Who is allowed in there? Who's allowed to talk to you? What are observers allowed to do? What are they allowed to say?
So there was some change to the rules that impacted the poll watchers. There are different people who are in the polling places, the election workers, and those are the people who are checking you in. And there's an election judge who's making sure all the rules are followed correctly, the procedures are followed correctly, so that everything's safe and secure. And then we have a group of folks that are assigned by a candidate, and they're called poll watchers. So a candidate or maybe somebody who has a proposition on the ballot can have a poll watcher there. And the new law allows a poll watcher more freedom of movement so that they can watch more closely people voting, which is a cause for concern. One good thing is that they do have to sign an oath and that they do have to take training that sort of certifies them as a poll watcher. But the new law is concerning to many folks, and we're going to have to watch and see how it impacts the actual polling locations. I think in general, the polling locations will be fine, but I think that there may be purposeful placement of poll watchers who will not behave, and it'll be harder to get rid of those poll watchers from certain polling places.
It's always important in this kind of story to also understand there were so many versions of this bill. I think people are rightfully confused, but I think it's important to note that many of the worst provisions, particularly as it pertains to these partisan poll workers and expanding their ability to intimidate voters, many of those worst provisions were taken out of the bill because so many thousands of Texans showed up and said, "We don't believe in this." That in a democracy, we are supposed to be able to cast a free and fair and private ballot, and these folks are not making that possible, right? And because so many people spoke out, many of the worst provisions in this part of the bill and many others were taken out. That doesn't mean it's a good bill. It's still a very bad bill, but it does mean that a lot of the harm that could have been caused by these lawmakers was taken out. And I think it's important that we celebrate those wins of activists and the everyday people who continue to show up.
If you were part of that effort, thank you. Jim, did you want to add something there?
Well, I just want to say that with the Civil Rights Project, we really, really enjoyed working with the League on a number of cases, particularly in East Texas, where high schools were trying to keep the league out. And obviously that's a tribute to critical thinking, which is not on the docket in East Texas. Great respect for the work that the league does. Sometimes I'm sorry they aren't more political, but I certainly understand where people are coming from in this regard. And in El Paso, too, is spectacular.
Mm-hmm. They do a great job out there.
Grateful for the efforts of all the people who at least got rid of the worst of the provisions in there. SB1 still passed. And since September, we've seen a couple of lawsuits. A rather major one was filed in September by the ACLU with I don't know how many community and advocacy groups, but I know the League of Women Voters is a party to that. It's my understanding that the complaint is that SB1 discriminates against persons with disabilities and non-English speakers. Then on top of that, in November, the U.S. Department of Justice added its own lawsuit. And the claim there, I haven't been through all the legalities of this, and I understand that neither you, Grace, nor Charlie are lawyers, but I believe the tack that DOJ is going for is that it violates provisions of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
I'm happy that the ACLU and the Texas Civil Rights Project are stepping forward and being our lawyers on this. I think it's a really important law and that we should step up and point out the problems that may be caused by this bill. But most of the time I let the lawyers talk about whatever aspects of the law that they're going to be fighting, and I let them deal with it.
Understandably. You know, I'm sure they're coming up with a strategy that they believe they can win with, you know, hence the focusing in on the persons with disabilities and non-English speakers, for example.
I think their job is certainly made more difficult, of course, by the gutting of the Voting Rights Act by the Supreme Court back in 2014. That makes this certainly an uphill battle, but also really renews the call that we desperately need right now for this federal elections bill, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which should be moving any day now, God willing. We desperately need these provisions. Texas stands to benefit from these pieces of legislation more than any other state. And hopefully we see that sooner than later.
There's a full circle here, too. I think that's important to mention. And that these cases are in front of judges who have been appointed by the administration in the past that was unfavorable to these rights. And I think it's really important that one of the items on the docket to get people to vote is to understand that this isn't just about who's in Congress or who's president or who's city council, but it's also about what are the judges going to look like after the election. The courts that we have right now, from the Supreme Court all the way down, are very hostile to civil rights, to say the least. And so while we talk about, you know, bringing a lawsuit under 14th Amendment or the Voting Rights Act or whatever, we're still looking at those judges and how they want to interpret the law. And I think for me, it's always been a very unspoken issue that the consequence of our elections are judges, and we don't put that on the table when we're talking, encouraging people to get out to vote.
It's sort of like poisoning the well, you know? I mean, how do you stop this? I guess somewhere the chain's got to be broken, right?
It's really important. Our democracy is so important to this country. And whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you want our democracy to continue. And most people agree that everyone should have fair and equal access to the ballot. And when that is stopped, then it makes it much harder to participate in our democracy and to get leaders in there who actually represent the community. Come on, guys, we're very concerned about our democracy right now. And everything that I see that's going on makes me even more concerned. And so that's why I think there should be those national For the People Act and the John Lewis Act are so important to states, especially Texas, Georgia, some of these southern states. It's just important that all voters in the United States have equal access to the ballot box.
So before, you were talking a little about League efforts in education. Between the League and MOVE, what can you do? What are you doing to compensate for these new restrictions? I mean, did you say you have videos online to educate people on this, for example?
Yes, we do. So we went through the law and then we chose the ones we thought would most impact voters. And then we tried to simplify everything so that we created simple videos on how to apply to vote by mail, simple videos on how to register to vote, how to update your voter registration, just to make it simple and easy for most voters. They could look beyond these complicated laws and just do what they need to do to participate. Because most voters out there, they're working, they have children, they have schedules, they have a lot going on, and they want to know how can they vote. What's the easiest way for them to participate and be a part of this democracy?
And is it as easy as going to the Vote411 website?
If you go to Vote411 and click on taxes, you'll have a lot of the voting information you need to participate in democracy. If you go to lwvtexas.org, you'll have more of the specific voter education for Texas. Because in Texas, it's a little bit different. We have open primaries. We're having a primary election coming along here next month. We have open primaries. That means anybody can vote in the primary. Once they vote in the primary, they need to stay with that party. So if you voted in the Democratic primary, you would vote in the Democratic primary runoff. And so it's simple things like that that voters need to know to participate in our elections here in Texas.
Yeah, and we're on the same lines there, building on what the League is doing. I think there's a lot of conversation to be had. We all kind of need to read the League fact sheet on the changes in these laws, the great resources from the Texas Civil Rights Project. The purpose of these laws was to make it where we would have these simple mistakes that would make it more difficult. And so we got to educate ourselves. We got to educate our friends because we can overcome that. So this is a really critical time to be having conversations just like this around the dinner table, looking up those resources and making sure that even months ahead of the election, we're ready to go.
It might be time to sit down with your grandma and, you know, say, do you need help with your vote by mail application? Let me help you do it.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on January 13th. Our guests are Grace Chemain from the League of Women Voters of Texas and Charlie Bonner from MOVE Texas. Let's pick up where we left off.
You know, for years and years, voting was so boring. It was simple. It was something that I would do, feeling some obligation as a citizen in a democracy that this was my right and my duty. And I never gave it a lot of thought. I mean, I certainly focused on the candidates and the issues that I was voting for, but I never gave much thought to the actual process of voting. And now that's changed. You know, now we need to pay a lot more attention to actually what we're doing and how this works.
I think you're so right. And I think we're hearing that from so many folks, particularly around the 2020 election, right? I think one, we were all trapped at home. All of the gears of the system were messed up. And so there was a lot of question there, but it really revealed for people how disjointed our election laws are across the country, how wonky this process can be, particularly in the counting of ballots. I think we remember that from 2020, the process there, really learning that all these different states had these laws. I think one of the great benefits of this has been around poll workers. I think 2020 was the first time we ever talked about poll workers amongst my friends. And we had young people in Texas running whole polling locations who had never talked about it before, right? And then we had people realizing that our democracy is run on the backs of our friends and neighbors that show up and give their time to work those polling locations. Our democracy is only as good as people giving up their time and making the system work. That's a great thing for all of us to be reminded of and use it as a motivating factor to get back involved in civic life. And I think that's what we're seeing in large part with the Freedom to Vote Act. I think this is really a turning point in this country right now.
I love what you said. Democracy is not boring. Democracy, it's how we have government. It's how we have roads. It's how we have infrastructure. It's how we have our traffic lights and our interstates and our railroads. That's how we work. Democracy is not boring. It is who we are as Americans, and we need to support it by being poll workers, by work for election protection, by joining the league or move, and be a part of the process. Be a part of making it better.
With all the focus on these voting rights bills before Congress and the filibuster and the politics of this going back and forth, I at times get discouraged. How about your own volunteers? Is it a challenge to keep up morale among your volunteers, or does this just come as a challenge and really fire people up?
I think this is a challenging time for morale for everyone, regardless of where you are, right? These are extraordinarily trying times. But I was so heartened over the past year. Texas really took the spotlight in this national movement for the freedom to vote. How many people showed up to the Texas Capitol time and time again? Generally, we had no notice that these elections hearings would take place. We had 24 hours, 48 hours to mobilize people from across the state to speak against these voter suppression efforts. And every time people showed up, every time they brought friends with them, and the crowds got larger, the lines to testify got longer and longer. And it was amongst the most inspiring times of my life, even in the face of so many setbacks. This terrible piece of cynical legislation. But I will always hold with me in this fight, particularly the last hearing we had on this. That hearing lasted 24 straight hours, and more than 400 Texans had shown up to speak against these voter suppression efforts. Many of them stayed that full 24 hours. I testified at about 6:30 in the morning after I had gotten there at 8 o'clock in the morning the day before. And folks had testified right before me, a couple that had driven down from Dallas and had their two small kids with them asleep in the back of the hearing room. It was not easy for those parents to stay there. No. I think so many people that day played with their kids, brought coloring books, tried to do anything that they could to make it where those parents could stay there. And they knew it was important for them, for their kids to see that at this moment, they stood up for democracy. That changed my life, seeing that moment, even though I hadn't slept in 2 days, right? To see their resolve of everyday people that were willing to travel, that were willing to stay even when it was hard, and make their voices heard in defense of our democracy. So I think at this trying time, there's still a lot to be inspired about and to be hopeful for.
Oh, you make me happy. Thank you for saying that. Remember, the legislative session was during COVID, before the boosters and all that. And so the problem with some of the legislation is that it impacted people who could not be there to testify, and they were not providing access to provide testimony for people who were disabled and who are very impacted by the COVID infection. And so they could not be there. And I thought that that was just horrible, that legislators pushed forward with legislation that impacted voters with disabilities. My background is nursing, pediatric nursing, so I am just very well aware of these issues, and I was horrified. I was also horrified by what was in the name of one of the bills. I think, what was it called? HB6 or something, and it had the purity of the vote in it. That goes back to the times after the Civil War, and it had the purity of the vote. The purpose of that, to keep the vote as white as possible. And I was horrified that a legislature now would use that term in their legislation. Do you remember that, Charlie?
Yeah, I mean, it was really one of the most astonishing moments of the legislative sessions, right? One, so many of us had pointed it out throughout the process, but it really took a shaming on the House floor on live TV to get that provision taken out of the bill.
Appalling. You would think we would have gotten past that, but it is not true. And it seems to be some of the efforts of the bill. He said he didn't know why. He didn't, I don't know why y'all take offense so easily. I'm like, hello. Yeah. I grew up in Texas. I know what they're trying to say.
What about going forward here? I don't expect you to lay out your strategic plans for your organizations, but could you talk a little about what you're doing and where you'd like to go with all of this?
Well, for me right now, in the league, is we are moving forward with simplifying our complicated election law and simplifying it in a way that voters can understand so they could be a part of the democratic process. And so we're creating videos when we can. I did that over the holidays. We're having a webinar next week about the voting laws. I've been meeting with organizations to explain the new voting laws and trying to do the voter education that you would think that the Secretary of State would be providing, but that is not always the case. And so organizations like MOVE, TCRP, and the League have to provide that voter education and try to get the word out. This is how you register to vote. This is how you fill out a vote by mail application. This is who to call election protection if you need help with filling out any of those applications, or if you have a problem at the polling place. So it's really all about voter education for me until after the election, and then I'll take a deep breath.
The feeling here, very mutual, making sure that our young people have access to the information that they need to be voters. We're also right now really engaged in voter registration ahead of this primary, which is made more difficult by the fact that campuses are closing and we don't have online voter registration in this state. So we've really modified our plans over the last couple of days. We're sending out more than 50,000 voter registration forms to young Texans across the state, calling and texting them, letting them know it's in the mail, letting them know we're there to help them fill it out and answer any questions that they have. So still trying to make a big impact this year as this pandemic wages on.
I'm impressed that you got all those names and addresses and you were actually able to do that.
Yeah, we ran this pilot of this program back in 2020, again, out of absolute pandemic-induced necessity. But we were still able to reach our voter registration goals that we had set prior to the pandemic to register more than 50,000 young people in 2020. We were still able to do that in the middle of a pandemic. And I think when I look back on this time, it'll be one of the things that I'm the proudest of, that we were still able to help empower those young people when so much wasn't able to continue.
I actually work for AISD. I'm a tutor at one of the high schools. And I know the librarian at the school is very politically active and has a whole stack of registration forms for the 18-year-olds, you know, when they turn 18, to get them, you know, registered as quickly as possible.
The librarians are often the ones in high schools that are assigned with the high school voter registration duty. It's a great place. I think everybody loves to go to the library. And libraries across Texas also are really vital for voter registration. Legally, they have to provide voter registration cards and offer voter registration to the people in their community. So we work closely with libraries across Texas.
Any other comments, observations, or points that you'd like to make? And certainly contact information. Charlie, why don't you wrap it up first?
Absolutely. Thanks again for having us today for this really important conversation. I think I would just close by saying I don't think there's ever been a more important time in our history to be a voter, to be someone who is willing to show up even when it's difficult and willing to say that you believe in this democracy by showing up, by casting a ballot, by speaking out right now. and having those conversations with our friends and our family. And so I'm proud to be doing this work alongside the folks at the League, but we need reinforcements. We need everybody who is listening to get involved in this fight. So you can join us at movetexas.org. You can also check your voter registration status and request a voter registration form at movetexas.org/register.
Well, I would just like to remind folks that there is an election coming up. It's the Texas primary election. It's on March 1st. And the last stage to register to vote is January 31st. And there's this new way that if you have moved or changed your name, if you're already registered, you can update your registration online at texas.gov. Voting early starts February 14th and goes through the 25th. And if you are going to vote by mail, send in your application as soon as possible so that if there's any difficulty, you can fix it so you'll be able to vote in this election. Voting is not about just you voting. It's about everyone in your community voting. So be sure when you vote, you make sure that your family, your friends, your community, your coworkers are all ready and they all have a plan to vote in this election. Our voter's guide is at vote411.org. It'll be available by the end of this month, I believe. And if you have any questions about voting, you could go to lwvtexas.org.
And Jim, did you have anything else you wanted to add there?
Well, I want to go back as an organizer and just reaffirm 100 times over what Charlie said, the importance of organizing, registering new voters, going door to door, showing up at grocery stores. That to me is really, really important, not only in terms of changing election outcomes, but it's going to offset a number of people who are going to be excluded, confused, and who don't vote because of the new laws. So I want to underline that over and over.
And research says if you ask people 7 times somehow, they get to hear about the election and you ask them to vote, that they will vote in that election. And once they vote in one election, they're going to vote in the next election too.
Willie Velasquez was of the opinion that if somebody showed up your door and asked you to vote for him or her, you would do it, regardless of the party of that person. That personal contact is so important. You know, we rely a lot on social media, but there's a chunk of people who aren't attuned to social media that we need to bang on their doors and talk to them.
Well, I really want to thank all of you for your time here today, but especially for all of your efforts. SB1 has made life difficult for a lot of people and has underscored all of the efforts on the part of the League and MOVE and related organizations. So on behalf of the community, thank you so much for your efforts and the very best to all of you.
Yeah, thanks for your timeless service.
All right. Well, I hope this gets out and that people share their voting experience so they could get more and more people around them to vote.
Thank you guys so much.
Well, again, it's Friday afternoon, January 21st. And once again, we have Austin Sanders with us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How are you doing today, Austin?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
You've been following a couple of interesting stories. Maybe we could lead off with this one about APD. Apparently, they commissioned a study, or the Greater Austin Crime Commission funded a study. What's going on there?
The Greater Austin Crime Commission, they're this kind of outside private group that supports law enforcement, mostly in Austin. They kind of lobby on behalf of the Austin Police Department. Yeah, they commissioned this study with a professor at the University of New Haven, which is a private school where most of the students are majoring in criminal justice, so this kind of a specialty. They contracted with this PhD named Dr. Giovanni Circo to study police staffing. Obviously, this has been a big issue for, you know, the past several years, but really kind of gained wider public attention through Save Austin's Now effort to get this 2 officers per 1,000 ballot measure passed in November. Failed pretty spectacularly at that, kind of an arbitrary figure, something that the Greater Austin Crime Commission nor APD Chief Joseph Chacon ever really embraced, right? You know, it's a pretty arbitrary number Chief Chacon had said all along that he wanted to take, you know, kind of a data-driven, evidence-based approach to determining how many patrol officers is always the big question the department should employ. And so this is kind of an effort at that, right? Even though APD, they partnered with this, they have a chief data officer who assisted with this. But again, it was a professor, a third party carrying out the research. But what this study concluded was that to maintain an average response time of 6.5 minutes to high priority 911 calls, APD needs to maintain 882 patrol officers. And that's about 108 more than the department is currently budgeted for, right? I should clarify, that's funding for 882 positions. That doesn't necessarily mean 882 police officers. There's always going to be vacant positions. It's kind of built into the staffing formula. Officers kind of depend on overtime as a way of increasing their income. And so that's kind of, you know, assumed that you're never going to fill all of those positions. But the research is interesting. Basically, what Dr. Serco did is he developed what's called a machine learning model, basically a complicated algorithm that analysts use to kind of study large data sets. And this was a pretty large data set. They looked at 6 million officer responses to 2 million 911 calls between 2016 and 2020. They looked at all calls, but what they were really interested in was what are classified as P0 or P1 calls. These are priority zero, priority one, the highest priority in the call system. And typically, these type of calls come with some kind of imminent threat to life and safety. You know, someone is waving a firearm, you know, or there's a shots fired call or robbery, burglary, these type of calls. And those calls were about 346,000 P0 or P1 calls. So a smaller subset of the data, but still a pretty significant portion. And they looked at where officers are stationed throughout the city, what happens when they're on less urgent calls, and how long it can take them to get off of one of those less urgent calls in response to a higher priority call. What happens in different parts of the city, say, if there's a lot of urgent calls downtown on a weekend, but then an urgent call comes in the northwest part of the city, how long can it take officers to get to the northwestern part of the city, just as an example? And yeah, again, what they found was that to maintain that 6.5 minute response time, you need a funding for about 108 more officers, which translates to, you know, a little more than $10 million in annual budget increase for APD.
Now, I assume this would find its way to Spencer Kronk's desk. And if it met council approval, then it would be folded into the budget. I mean, what's the process here?
Yeah, it's just a study, right? It's not a formal policy recommendation. It's a study conducted by, you know, an outside group. And Chief Chacon, when the study released about 2 weeks ago, he held a press conference to kind of answer questions and he addressed this topic. He said it was just one tool that he would be using to determine budget requests, staffing levels. Although, you know, he's always, like I had said earlier, said that he wants to look at the department's strategy through a data lens and evidence-based different approaches. So this is something I think will be important to him. He did not rule out the idea of even asking for a mid-year budget amendment, which would be kind of unusual, right, for the police department to ask for funding for more officers outside of the regular annual budget process. But we're kind of in a different world post-2020 budget where, for the first time in, you know, at least 10 years or more, the police department lost funding for officer positions. So Chacon is talking to council member offices and looking at other metrics, talking to other sources before presenting a formal recommendation to Spencer Kronk, the city manager, about what the department needs in terms of patrol staffing.
And so how is this being received by members of Reimagining Public Safety, for example?
Yeah, I mean, as you might suspect, they're a little suspicious of this recommendation for spending more than $10 million to fund 100 new officer positions. What I'm hearing most frequently is the fact that the study excluded what are called officer-initiated calls. It only looked at 911 calls. So an officer-initiated call is just an officer out on patrol sees something they think is suspicious and decides to investigate. Officers spend about a third of their time on officer-initiated calls, and they are about half as likely to result in a police report compared to 911 calls. And what that tells us is about 14% of the time in these officer-initiated calls, they're not finding any criminal activity, not arresting anyone, not issuing citations, stuff like that, because a police report, you know, if there is criminal activity, it requires a police report. So advocates are saying, if we want to improve response time, maybe we should look at these officer-initiated activities, have better management and regulation of how officers are spending their time there, rather than just kind of defaulting to the tried and true, historically chosen path of hiring more officers, especially since we're kind of in this reimagining public safety period. So that's kind of the primary concern I'm hearing from advocates.
Maybe better ways to spend $10 million, I'm guessing.
Right. Yeah, that's the gist of it.
So there are the concerns about response times from APD. At the same time, we've got staffing issues over at EMS, not the least of which is people out sick with COVID. What's going on over there?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty bad for a while. I think the situation is improving, but earlier this month, the department went into what's called level 2 operations. It's kind of like the DEFCON system. I think it goes from like 4 to 1 in terms of like different measures the department can take to respond to emergencies and crises. And for the first time in the department's history, it moved to level 2 because this, again, was toward the beginning of January, but in the week prior, somewhere around 20% of the sworn personnel, you know, the people who staff ambulances and run emergency calls, were out on quarantine or with COVID. So a really dire staffing situation. The department is at the end of a search for a new chief. The candidates list has been narrowed to 2 choices. Jasper Brown, who has been with Austin EMS for more than 2 decades, he's been serving as the interim chief since last year, since the prior chief, Ernie Rodriguez, stepped down after more than a decade as chief. He's one of the candidates. And then this outside candidate, Robert Luckritz, who is a former EMS chief and hospital administrator in the Northeast, are the final 2 candidates. So this is a really pivotal moment overall for the department. You know, you have medics, frontline medics, experiencing burnout, facing these really harsh working conditions throughout the pandemic. They're in search of a new chief who, you know, medics are really hoping for someone to bring a fresh perspective, new ideas to the table. They've been really frustrated with leadership over the past several years. They're also in the middle of renegotiating their new labor contract with the city of Austin, which occurs every 4 years. So a lot going on with EMS and their medics. You know, they're really hoping for relief after a really hard 2 years on the front lines of a pandemic.
I can only imagine that morale must be at an all-time low. It's got to be like warfare out there, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I talk with a number of medics with varying, you know, lengths of tenure with the department, and many feel morale has never been this low, you know, in their personal experience. It's the combination of really harsh working conditions and burnout, low pay compared to other EMS fields in the private sector, especially, and really, again, frustration with leadership over the past, I would say, decade, even stretching back, but especially in the recent years. One example I highlighted in the story that I wrote this past week is Interim Chief Brown announced that medics volunteering to fill shifts that would go unfilled because someone's out for COVID or whatever it may be, medics will get double pay, right? 2 times their pay, whatever their hourly wage is for filling those shifts. That's increased from 1.5 times pay for the past 2 years. This has been a big improvement to morale, But the question has to be asked, why did it take 2 years for this change to be made, right? This is something kind of like COVID hazard pay. Financial incentive is something medics have been, you know, really begging for 2 years. And it's just now happening when kind of resentment and frustration has reached a fever pitch among medics.
When do they plan to have a new chief selected?
There's no definite date. I'd expect it to be pretty soon now that it's down to the two candidates. They held a town hall with both candidates. There was a, you know, a web portal accepting feedback. So the city manager's office has the feedback that they need. So I'd expect an announcement here pretty soon.
Well, plenty to keep our eyes on there at Austin-Travis County EMS. That's for sure. Really hope that that matter comes to some sort of resolution soon. And just as we're hoping that COVID comes to some resolution soon, I suppose, huh?
Right.
Well, thanks so much for joining us as always. And we look forward to speaking with you next week.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
That's all from us this evening. Stay safe, everyone.